Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, and welcome to a special broadcast to celebrate the fifth anniversary of Sound Ideas with a GLT conversation, local journalism in the era of fake news. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate for a moment to prefer the latter." Jefferson didn't write the First Amendment, but he most certainly influenced James Madison, who did. Among other things, the First Amendment protects free speech and free press. U.S. free press advocate Trevor Tim is a TED Talk speaker, and he said of the First Amendment, "It has always been the bulwark against secret government, against authoritarianism, and against tyranny." But newspapers and electronic media are facing challenges. A recent poll by Canada's largest public polling firm shows almost a third of Americans agree that the news media is the enemy of the people. It also shows a growing willingness to put limits on a free press. A free press is under attack from the White House, and media companies face financial challenges as where we go to get our news changes. During this community conversation, we'll explore the challenges, the attacks, and how to respond. Joining us for this conversation are five longtime journalists. Catherine Murphy is a mother, wife, award-winning producer, host, and news director with more than 25 years experience. In 2006, she was hired to launch Oprah Radio with Sirius XM and worked her way up to become operations manager. With stops in Peoria, the Quad Cities, Seattle, and Chicago, she's happy to be back in Central Illinois. She joined WJBC as news director in July. Laura Trendelpolis has never worked for Oprah, but has been in the same room with her, I've been told. She's been the director of Illinois State University's TV 10 News for 15 years. She instructs and oversees a team of about 60 journalism students who produce 8 live local shows each week, more than any other university in Illinois. She also helps place students in internships and jobs. And Laura is a former newscast producer at WISN-TV in Milwaukee and WMBD-TV in Peoria. And she's in her third year as president of the Illinois News Broadcasters Association. Does GLT's Charlie Schlinker need an introduction to this audience? Charlie Schlinker has 3 decades of experience, much of that as assistant news director and news director at WGLT. He's also the recipient of several national Edward R. Murrow Awards. Mark Pickering has served as editor of the Pantograph since 2010. He's also deputy regional editor of the Central Illinois News Group, a graduate of the University of Missouri School of Journalism. He began as a reporter in Bloomington in 1982 with a stint as editor at the Mount Vernon Register News. He's a longtime member of the Associated Press's Media Editors Association. And Jim Kirk was most recently editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times and is senior vice president of strategic initiatives for Trunk, Inc., owner of the Chicago Tribune and several other major metropolitan newspapers. A veteran of the journalism and publishing industry, Kirk has served as the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chicago Sun-Times. He was previously chief of editorial operations at Crain's Chicago Business, and prior to that, the managing editor at the Chicago News Cooperative. He's also worked in Washington, D.C. at Bloomberg News, overseeing coverage of the White House, Congress, and other federal agencies. Everyone, welcome, and thanks for giving your time to this discussion. Jim Kirk, let's begin with you. You're a veteran reporter and editor. You've worked in Washington, D.C. Can you compare and contrast pre- and post-Trump eras? Are we indeed in unprecedented times when it comes to covering the news?
That's an easy question. Is there going to be a harder one later? Yeah, so no doubt we are in uncharted territory on all sorts of fronts, especially when it comes to at least in this generation of a president that not only has lashed out and sees media as its harshest critic, but has really gone on the attack in a way that we haven't seen anybody from the White House, let alone anyone really in any major government office in Washington, do the things that he's doing right now, and is having what I believe is a major effect on how the public perceives journalism and journalists and the job that journalists do, and by using the term fake news, has it's almost this perfect storm where you do have a situation where fake news is a real issue. You have a president that's using that term loosely to throw at legitimate news organizations and really confusing, I think, a number of people who I think are looking for, obviously, legitimate news sources on a daily basis to be informed. And so we are in an incredible period here that I think most of us have never seen before.
So what is the effect on news coverage and news consumers of this kind of top-down criticism from the White House?
I don't see the effect on news coverage other than a lot of, and Mark may have a different perspective, but there's been obviously a lot of internal discussion, I think, in newsrooms about we are under attack, how do we deal with this, what really is the perception out there among readers. But on a daily basis, you know, you have hardworking journalists trying to get the job done, get the story. I don't think it's on a daily basis affecting it, but then you do see, you know, some reaction, as you saw the New York Times, sort of extraordinary steps where a publisher you know, reaches out to the president, to the White House, to have a discussion about what his statements might be doing in this time and what the harm it might be causing. Those are the types of things that it's more of an internal hand-wringing, I think, rather than, from my perspective, I don't see an effect on the day-to-day reporting that reporters do, or the assignments that editors give out, or the photos that photographers are taking, or video. But it certainly is sort of the elephant in the room.
And Mark Pickering with the Pantograph.
I would agree with everything Jim said. And I think on a local level, when you come down to a mid-sized market like Bloomington Normal, McLean County, we don't go about changing the way we assign our stories or who we assign our stories to. But to sort of piggyback on the social media thing with its president using Twitter all the time to get his points of view across, that's really a two-way street. And I've been talking about this for a while. You know, social media has been, it's revolutionary how we communicate with each other. On one hand, you've got, it's easier sometimes to find out what's going on and then decide whether to report on it. But then you have to filter through a lot of the junk that comes through. It's inaccurate, it's false, but it's out there and you have to check a lot of stuff out. So for every legitimate tip and story angle you get from a social media avenue, the other half is no good. And so reporters have to work harder to filter through that stuff to decide, should I go after this story, should I not go after that story? That said, you know, we in Bloomington at the Pantograph, we're not getting that kind of reaction feedback from either the public or from the agencies and the people that we cover. They don't do that. Mayor Renner's had a few problems, which we've reported on. But generally speaking, we're a local newspaper. We cover local news. We cover, you know, government, education, the courts, crime, public safety. And we do that like we always have been. We don't have as many people doing it, but we're doing it the way we were. So we sort of look at that as that's noise. We have to stay true to what we're doing, and if there's a story there, find it and write it accurately and fair. And that's what we try to do every day.
And Catherine Murphy with WJBC, do you find yourself, your newsroom, sort of tracking down all these leads, working harder for fewer stories?
Well, and we have fewer people in our newsroom now, so we're working twice as hard trying to track down these stories. And like Mark said, we really are kind of wearing our blinders just to filter out the noise, because you can't win. If you're even reporting on fake news or you're reporting on real news, depending on who the critic is, it's going to be called fake news.
Charlie Schlinker with WGLT.
And some local office holders or local citizens are, in fact, buying into the name throwing, and they are viewing the institutions of the media with less credibility than they used to. And that also complicates how we do things, because some of those people who have legitimate points of view and are thoughtful people are not as willing to talk to reporters as they used to be, and so their voices are left out, and the quality of the discourse is thinned.
And it's not helping our cause in some cases where Sinclair Broadcasting was having their news outlets report what they wanted the news outlets to report, which was in fact not true. So that doesn't help our cause either in those situations.
And Laura Trendopoulos with Illinois State University, you're nodding your head and something you want to say.
I am. Sinclair, as an educator, Sinclair came up a lot in my classrooms in this last year and also in my role with the Illinois News Broadcasters Association. So I wrote a response on behalf of our organization, and I'm sure we've all seen that video with all the talking heads and all the promos that the anchors did and that echo chamber kind of thing. So I wrote a response in defense of the hardworking journalists, the people, because they don't, you know, they don't walk around with that Sinclair name tattooed on their forehead. They are people trying to cover stories. I also invited the nearest Sinclair news director from WICS in Springfield to come and speak to my class of seniors just so that they could see that there's a face. So, yes, I see what worries me about Sinclair and how that's not the direction and how that is eroding the trust. But then there's also a newsroom of hardworking journalists who think they're doing a really good job of covering local Springfield stories and challenged our students to look at anything on their website and find where their bias was, because they don't think that they think they're doing what all of us are doing.
Sinclair is an ownership group. They own, how many TV stations do they own?
Too many to count.
More than 200.
So the failing New York Times, as the president is fond of saying, is not failing, quite the opposite. NPR and the Washington Post have added reporters. Jim Kirk, is covering the current administration in any way good for business?
Oh, God.
Yeah, I think it's been tremendous for especially the Washington Post and the New York Times. There's been a lot written about that. You know, there's always going to be a counterweight to the prevailing kind of noise coming out of the White House and in Washington in general. I do think we are in a time of significant polarization. So whether it was Trump who just by the morning tweet makes news, or if it were someone on the Democratic side, I think in the White House right now, I think you would see significant interest in what's happening in Washington just because of the polarization that we're now seeing. Whether that pendulum swings the other way or we get some equilibrium, I mean, the midterms obviously will be a huge indicator of where the national psyche is right now. Remains to be seen, but we are definitely in a time where what's coming out of Washington is of high interest, and I think probably whether you're a small local paper to obviously a major city newspaper, it is a story that needs to be covered. And I will say just in my stint in LA, so obviously LA considered by many a liberal part of the, certainly by the president, a liberal part of the country. I would say the LA Times readership pretty heavily, you know, leans left, but certainly we got a number of complaints on a daily basis on our coverage of, especially on the editorial page, coverage of issues related to politics and government. This is a president that has focused specifically on very California issues that are near and dear to many on both sides of the aisle. Immigration, climate, environment. So from my standpoint at the LA Times, and we saw this in our analytics, just the first Trump visit when he went down to look at some prototypes of the wall down in Southern California, just the run-up to that visit and the stories that we did on that, high engagement, real intense kind of readership, people spending a lot of time on those stories. So the Trump story is a great story for journalists and also from covering it.
Some of the comments we received at Facebook and questions we received at WGLT.org sort of asked, should every tweet from the president be news? Should every rally that is like the last rally or the next rally be covered, or should there be more judgment as to whether or not that should make the headline or the news? Mark Pickering?
There's literally a dozen of those kinds of stories floating out there on any given day at any given time. You know, trickling down to the local level, you know, we focus on local news as much as we can. where we do not get any pushback from, you know, what's going on in Washington or the overall atmosphere of divisiveness coming out of the White House or whether the White House is causing it. To that point, where we get it is, as Jim mentioned, is mostly you're going to get it on your editorial page. Mm-hmm. The number one complaint I get from people who do call in, and they're usually Trump supporters all the time, they're Trump supporters if they do call in, is that the syndicated material that we're running is mostly bashing Donald Trump, taking opposite positions of what he's doing. And we try very hard to find a balance. I mean, we run certain columnists like George Will and so forth that we're contracted to run, and George Will is not a fan of the president. Right. But he's traditionally been considered a conservative. Mm-hmm. And there's other columnists like him, too. Trying to find syndicated material with an opinion commentary that supports the president is very hard to find. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of it out there. And so we really have to work hard to find that on a seven-day basis, try to get some balance into that editorial page to reflect that there's a lot of people in this community who are Donald Trump supporters. So that is a challenge on a local level at a paper our size.
And WGLT News Director Charlie Schlenker, something you wanted to add?
The traditional argument for covering every single tweet, every single news appearance, every single campaign stop / event that the president does is that they are an iteration of the president trying to enact his policy. And that is worth covering as a measure of how the president and his party tries to fulfill the campaign promises. The downside of that is that, particularly under the present administration, where so many of the utterances are questionable and require follow-up, is that if you carry the story on first impression, you're obligated to carry it again and again as further corrections or further responses happen. And that perpetuates the image of covering every bated breath when you really are only talking about certain episodes that continue to chain out in consecutive news cycles.
Laura Trendopoulos with TV10 and the Illinois News Broadcasters Association.
Television needs to have a camera on him at all times. That's not going to stop. Then the question is, what do you do with it?
Cover it, but
yes.
Do you have to?
Always need to be there.
Always need to cover it.
People on Facebook all the time are asking, why don't you just stop going? Stop covering him. Stop paying attention to him.
But then does there need to be more judgment be on the back end as to whether
yes.
or not you use it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. There could be. There should be. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you wait long enough, his story's going to change. So.
Well, and one of the issues there is, and Jim can probably speak to this a lot more from a national point of view, is there are so many media outlets and even so-called media organizations that are hanging, that, you know, could be considered hanging on every word that Donald Trump says. And you don't want to not do it because the guy next door is going to do it. So you can't be second or third. So everybody jumps on the bandwagon, and then it's it can be turned into a free-for-all. So that's one of the real dilemmas with the media today is if they say, we're not going to do a story every... If Associated Press said, we're not going to do an overnight story on every tweet that the president said because he got up on the wrong side of the bed today, that's not going to fly. Because whoever's running the Associated Press is going, you're not doing that. We need to get that story out there, and whether they use it or not is up to them. I mean, it's a cooperative. Mm-hmm. Some we post on our website, many we don't, because there's too many of them. It can be a dilemma in choosing what you think is newsworthy and what is not newsworthy.
What I think many newsrooms are grappling with is how do you cover, you obviously cover, you know, policy by tweet, right? Those that you know, if he's going to say he's going to slap another $16 billion in tariffs on China, that is a significant story that has local effects on local economies as well as makes international news. What gets interesting and difficult, I think, for newsrooms is how do you cover the inaccuracies or false statements that come out either by tweet or sometimes by official statement. The knee-jerk, which is a good reaction from newsrooms, is to cover straight and then maybe counter it in the story. There have been some who say there needs to be a different approach when you have a president like this who does not sometimes accurately, or give false statements. How do you cover that as a news organization? Do you cover it differently? Do you write a straight story and then you say, well, that's actually not true? Or do you start with some other kind of narrative way of writing that? The Washington Post almost, I think, I don't know if it's out daily or every few days, gives a list of all the falsehoods that have been uttered by the president and does sort of an analysis on that. Is that enough? Do people read that? I think there's some real question there about how to cover that type of...
Yeah, so what's the effect of regularly calling out the president's contradictory statements? Does it simply feed into the view that some media is anti-Trump and purveyors of fake news? They're just not going to believe...
I think Jim sort of touched on something earlier. It's going to be very interesting to see how the midterms come out in November, because there's a lot of races, there's a lot of stuff going on in Kansas right now and a few other places that are congressional primaries and whatnot are being called, they're a testament to whether the president's still got support, and if he doesn't have support, that goes on and on. But I think the midterms are going to be really interesting, because if the Democrats can regain, obviously, one of the houses, the Senate or the House, that can be seen probably without argument as something that Trump couldn't control. But beyond that, I don't really know what impact it has. There's a very core percentage of this electorate that support Donald Trump regardless of what he says, regardless of what he does. That's evident everywhere. It's not just in truly red states. It's all over, including central Illinois. So, you got this core who he said during the campaign he could kill somebody on a sidewalk and people would still vote for him. There's a lot of truth to that. A lot of truth to that. So I think the midterms are going to be interesting, because if one of the chambers flips, I don't know if he can change his behavior, but I think that it's going to send a real message to the country about maybe where the second 4 years, if he's elected, is going to go.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to a GLT Community Conversation, local journalism in the era of fake news. GLT's Community Conversations are made possible with a grant from the Alice and Fannie Fell Trust. Let's go to our audience quickly here. Dennis Fox has a question about how to deal with the notion of fake news. Dennis, what's your question?
My rather pointed query is that, how does one seriously address the topic of fake news when the single most individual contributor to this problem is other than President Donald Trump? Why is it so hard to flat out call the man a liar? He has no manners, so why should the mainstream press, not Trump TV, be afraid to call the man exactly what he is? He has no discretion, so why should the press?
Charlie Schlenker, would you like to take that question? it sounds like Dennis is asking, should the media stoop to Trump's level?
Well, there are a couple different responses to be made. One is that the old saying from the Chicago City News Bureau is, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. So you don't call them a liar. You say this is not factual, or that is untrue. Calling the president untrue is a growth industry right now. If you look at PolitiFact and factcheck.org and Snopes and the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Hill and Politico, out of the media landscape that is showing declining numbers of reporters, those specialty publications that cover the institutions of government in the capital, and those are the ones that are adding reporters. So there's a tremendous response that has happened to that.
I think there's also, at least when I was growing up being a journalist, he's still the president of the United States. And when I was growing up, that was the most revered office in the world. And I think that for some of us, as much as we want to call him a liar, there's still that feeling of tact. And as much as you want to, he's still the president of the United States. You wake up every day hoping maybe today he won't tweet.
Yeah. You can also get analysts to say, there is obviously a political motivation for this. He scheduled this tweet at this time for this political reason, and this is why it's happening now.
Another question submitted at WGLT.org. Do you think, this is from Jonathan Nord, and this is for the entire panel, do you think Americans do a good job of distinguishing between facts, opinion, and fake news? Who wants to take that question? You're shaking your head, Catherine Murphy with WJBC.
I would say no. I mean, just with all of the stuff that's gone on Facebook, somebody gets a hold of one story and it just grows and grows and grows and grows. And then the minute you start to, you go to Snopes or you go someplace and say, no, that's really not what happened, then a hellstorm breaks out and you're the enemy. It turns on you then because people want to believe what they read. They're always looking to, this is something that I thought of, they always look at us to be the bad guy because they need somebody to blame because surely they can't be wrong. This is a story they found on the internet. If it's on the internet, it has to be true.
Jim Kirk?
I think you raise a good point there. Nobody wants to be lied to. We're all human. And once you're lied to, you feel angry and you feel like you've been snowed, right? So I think to the points that have sort of been brought up here, I do think people believe that if something is on a platform, a social platform like Facebook, that it has to be true because it looks like news, it kind of smells like news. And there was not enough people checking whether or not that was true. And we now see what happened leading up to the election and how long it's taking the social platforms to try to get a handle on that. I do think, and rightly so, you're probably seeing the effects of that. Facebook's usage has slowed dramatically, costing them a lot of money in the past few weeks. And obviously the move on Alex Jones this past week and InfoWars starting to take down some of those statements, that's the first dramatic step we've seen the newer social platforms take. And that has to be done. And that will help, I believe it will help all of us as journalists and as news organizations if there is internal control on some, they were allowing things on their platforms that newspapers would not allow because it's just untrue. There has to be some responsibility taken there.
Related to that previous question, what's fake to you might not be fake to me. News consumers can curate their own news from sources which confirm their worldview. Jim Kirk with Tronc, owner of several major metro newspapers, what's the solution? It seems, this seems self-segregating and puts some of us in entirely different information universes.
Now it's going to sound like I'm going to contradict myself. Because there is, obviously there's a freedom of speech issue here. And, in some cases, the truth is not always a straight line. So what constitutes opinion that's truthful versus a belief that's completely untrue? Listen, those are decisions that have been made in newsrooms on a daily basis forever. And sometimes you get it right, sometimes you don't. There is nobody in this room, I think, would want any kind of censorship. But I do think there is a responsibility on everybody who's involved in whether you're distributing content or creating content to make sure what you're putting out there is truthful. And as long as you use that as sort of your North Star, I think you're going to be on a pretty good path.
Anyone else want to comment about?
The thing that's ironic to me is it's so much easier to get information through all of the social media and all of the other electronic avenues. You can learn about what's going on in Washington, what's going on in the White House, what have you. I mean, there's thousands of them. So, it's easy to just sit there and gather and take all this in. But as citizens and voters, you have to actually today work harder to find the information that's factual and that you can rely on to make a proper decision. So, in the old days, you read the newspaper and you watched TV news and you listened to the radio and you went to election, local forums and whatnot. And that was pretty much how you decided which candidate you were going to vote for example. Now you're bombarded with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ways that you're getting this information. You don't know what's right and what's wrong. So you actually have to work in this technological age that we're in. You have to actually work harder to get the information that you can rely on. And I find that fascinating.
But are consumers actually doing that, or are they?
I don't know. If you're going to make an informed decision about who you're going to vote for example, you better do that because if you just rely on what you're hearing and what you're seeing on social media, you're probably not going to make an accurate decision.
I could get all my information from Fox and make a decision.
Well, and I was going to say, there's a very fine line between who's a newscaster journalist and who's not. And people are taking the word of some of these people that are screaming things on TV as, well, he's on TV. Surely he's a journalist and knows exactly what he's talking about. Of course he's done all of his research. He's not doing this for ratings. Never. And that's where the lines kind of get blurred between what is going to be real news and what's not.
Do you have something you wanted to add, Laura?
I couldn't agree more.
Okay.
The screaming, the shouting, and it's on the radio too.
It
not
is.
Just
oh
on
yeah.
Television.
Well, and that's and that's one of the things that I've only been back in Central Illinois for a month now. But one of the things with JBC is that we don't carry any of that. All of our programming is live until late in the evening, and was one of the most refreshing moments of my life to not have to come in and listen to a Rush Limbaugh or listen to a Bill O'Reilly or anyone like that, because our company would generally carry those programs on Cumulus radio stations.
This is Sound Ideas on GLT, Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Coming up, the results of a questionnaire asking the audience at this forum about what they think are the most important issues for local media to cover. Jim, some of our Facebook and online comments wanted us to ask you and the other reporters here how they consume news. So what do you do? Mark Pickering touched on this, use a variety of sources, but what do you do? Where do you go?
Me personally?
Yes.
I'm 12, 13 hours a day scanning dozens of sites on a daily basis.
So it's a fire hose.
In LA, it was everything. Obviously, California, we thought ourselves as the voice of California. So obviously, I wanted to know what San Diego was writing about, what's happening in San Francisco. We were covering the fires up north and earthquakes out in Mexico. So a lot of national news, New York Times, Washington Post, obviously politics, Politico, The Hill, just sort of on a daily basis. A lot of it, I have to say, by Twitter, it's a great kind of headline resource for journalists.
How often do you click through?
On a daily basis?
Yeah, on Twitter. Do you just look at the headline, or are you clicking through to?
Well, I would say if there's a story that or a headline that catches my attention, I'll obviously click through. I don't click through everything. I use it more as sort of a kind of a headline resource that I'm scrolling through on a daily basis. And I will occasionally check out Facebook. Again, I'm looking at mainly legitimate news sources that people are sharing with me. So. Or sources that I've liked and show up in my news feed.
Laura Trindopoulos, how do you consume news? Where do you go?
I stay very local just because of where I am. I try to watch a good variety of the Peoria TV stations so as not to offend any of them. I was in one of their newsrooms this afternoon doing a little research, and it was a great time and a very spirited news meeting that I got to attend. But I'm also a little worried that the other one across the river will be mad that I didn't visit them.
So we don't have to name names, but what are some of the things you heard in the newsroom?
I actually heard this story be pitched, this event be pitched as a story, and the reporter who pitched it is over there, Stephanie Rodriguez. And I said, no, don't come with the camera. But it actually led to a pretty spirited debate. About half the table, I would say, said, if we do a story about fake news, we give more credence to it. Let's not do that. And then the other half said, no, we need to defend ourselves, and we need to incorporate our own policy and our own standards and let our audience know that that's not us and explain to them why. And it went on for a while, and she's here.
And Charlie Schlinker, same question. How do you consume news? Where do you go? I assume NPR is on the list.
Maybe, yeah. Now and again. No, every day. The New York Times, I too go to The Hill and Politico. Chicago Tribune, Springfield Journal Register, Peoria Journal Star, The Pantograph, of course. I take the zeitgeist of the area by checking some local blogs, but really I try not to read in detail or the comments, God help me. And I use Facebook, but largely to look at local potential local event coverage, not for news, but to determine whether we're going to go out and do something.
And Mark Pickering with the Pantograph, what do you think traditional media outlets can learn from online competitors like the Bloomington Normal Restaurant Scene or AdaptBN or, you know, the blog I think Charlie's referencing is BLN News?
Yeah. We monitor those sites too, and a lot of the times we know that what we're seeing is not true. Our reporters have maybe looked into some of that stuff and it's just not there. But I think it's important to just flat out, I think Charlie makes a good point. You can look at these blogs and so forth and say, you know, sometimes they got something and you should be on it. And either you're late on it or, you know, whatever. And you can't just say, well, you know, we got beat by, you know, some neighborhood blog. That's not how the newspaper business goes. If it's a story, then you go get the story and you find a new way to tell that story. But I think it's important that everything be taken with a grain of salt. So you brought up the restaurant blog, which Larry Karius is a guy I've gotten to know. I'm trying to get him to write a column for us, but he won't do it. He's busy eating out all the time. The guy eats out all the time. And all these restaurant guys know this guy, you know, and he's a real character, but he's a great guy. But, you know, he has an in, and he said to me, that's all he does really is talk. He wants to talk about restaurants and what they're doing and adding to their menus and stuff. So that's sort of his hobby, but he doesn't want to turn it into a paid kind of thing. He just likes to do it. So we're looking at his site all the time because he'll have a little blurb that says, "Hey, I heard that, you know, there's a new Mexican restaurant opening on the east side." And like, God, Jesus, he's got this story again. So we have to go track it down, right? And 7 times out of 10, the guy's right. Mm-hmm. But there's times where he's wrong. But 7 times out of 10, he's probably right. And getting the restaurant people to talk to you is always, because they're so busy, is crazy. But, you know, I think you have to use every news source that is out there and treat it as a potential for a story. But treat it that way. And don't listen, as Charlie says, don't listen to the noise. Don't pay attention to the comments. You want to get in. If you try to embroil yourself into that atmosphere, you're going to lose because you cannot extricate yourself once you get involved in that. So we stay away from any of that kind of game.
Charlie Schlenker with WGLT.
One other minor nuance to that is another reason to pay attention to some of the less credible bloggers is sometimes public officials take those folks to heart and exercise less than desirable discipline. And even if they're not saying anything about it, it can affect their thought. And some of their public utterances do tend to creep one side or the other, and you have to get a sense of where that's coming from.
This is Sound Ideas on GLT, Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to a GLT Community Conversation, local journalism in the era of fake news. GLT's Community Conversations are made possible with a grant from the Alice and Fannie Fell Trust. And as I said earlier, we'll get the results of that questionnaire. According to the General Social Survey, or GSS survey, the number of Americans with a great deal of trust in the press has dropped 30 percentage points since the late 1970s. Any ideas what might be behind that? Are journalists doing something wrong? Is this a result of the media landscape becoming more fractured? Jim?
Journalists have too much to do. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Laura.
I'm not coming here looking for sympathy, but I just want the audience to understand to some degree what they're facing. I'll pick on Stephanie again. You see, she's by herself. That used to be a two-person crew. I saw somebody got a photographer today at that news meeting. It wasn't you. Most of the people don't get to work with someone anymore. So her brain is involved with double the workload. She's doing the work of two people. And did you have to get a VO in Morton on the way over here? At a place that's going to turn into a hot dog place? Okay. So you did
that. She just gave us a scoop.
You did that. I have a student who is interning at the other Peoria station this summer, and she did 8 VOSATs in one day. A VOSAT is a 45-second story where you get one interview.
So are you...
A college student wrote 8 stories in one day for a professional newsroom.
So how does that affect the public's trust in the media and this erosion over the past 30 years?
I think you are right to have some erosion in trust because you can see this happening.
So they're not paying attention to details? They're not as accurate?
They probably aren't. How can they be with that much work to do? And then I always am interested to see when there's a new anchor on a Peoria station or on any station for that matter, people will always chime in and say, well, I hope we get to keep this one for more than a couple years. Well, you probably won't because the contracts are that long and there's burnout and there are better opportunities to leap up in markets much more quickly, but that's also eroding the trust.
Charlie Schlenker.
There are a couple institutional issues for loss of trust as well. One, there are far fewer journalists in the internal part of the country. Certainly that's not true in Washington or the major cities where there are some fewer, but not the hollowing out of journalism, the 50% reductions, or today we heard that a prominent Colorado newspaper is a third of the editorial staff that it once had. So people who are reading and viewing and listening know that there are fewer resources and that they can't do what they once did. That's one thing. The other thing is with the expansion of national coverage, the heartland is not getting what it once got, and it was always given short shrift. And so you have Trump country saying, these people are not speaking to my issues, and therefore I do not trust them.
I referenced another poll earlier, recently released by Ipsos, a large Canadian polling firm. It shows a stark political divide between Democrats and Republicans in their view of the media. For instance, do most media outlets try their best to produce honest reporting? 68% of Democrats believe in the good intent of journalists. Only 29% of Republicans agree. And is the news media the enemy of the American people? Nearly a third agreed with this sentiment, including 48% of Republicans. Laura Trendopoulos with ISU and the INBA, is this view of journalists and journalism affecting the numbers of young people deciding to choose journalism as a career?
Well, I believe so. However, it's also firing up some, and I've been happy to see that. I just had a group graduate in May, and Stephanie was part of that, and 11 of them were working in television newsrooms by the 4th of July, between May and the 4th of July. And I've been there 15 years, and I've never had a year like that. So, and they're just on fire. They wanted to go get jobs. They wanted to start producing shows and telling stories and interviewing people and so forth. But I still feel it in my classes that there is, if you're not sure, then you're even more not sure than you were before, if that makes sense. If there's any wavering, then you're gonna say, no, this just doesn't seem like a great career right now. But those who are on fire for it are taking this to heart and jumping in.
So keeping that political breakdown in mind, could we assume that more liberals than conservatives choose journalism as a career, and that could perpetuate a liberal bias?
I don't ask them any political, that does not. Do you vote, Stephanie? I don't know.
I'll resist that liberal bias trope. I think that it's well proved through studies over many years from Pew and Poynter and places like that the media have a centrist bias. They copy the attitudes of the markets they serve. And if there is a liberal bias, it's because there are fewer reporters at institutions in conservative areas because the economics don't work for newspapers and broadcast much anymore.
And Mark Pickering with the Pantograph.
And on a local level, like, again, here in Bloomington, Normal, McLean County, Central Illinois, most of our reporters are not, they're not writing about, stories with a national significance. I mean, you're covering a city council meeting, there's no bias there. You're just covering the council meeting, a lot of our elections are nonpartisan here, although we know who's running and what party they're from. So, reporters at this level, and I think all over, they don't go into it like that. I've had that conversation with a lot of people over the years. They get an assignment, they do the job. and they don't bring their political viewpoint into it. If I ever read a story that was that had an obvious political slant to it for some reason, trust me, that reporter wouldn't
in that order.
Maybe not be around very long.
And that's why they make editors.
That story would be spiked or rewritten, what have you. But on a national level, I think there's the greater debate, and probably Jim can address that. But on a local level, that's just not an issue.
Yeah, I think more on a national level, again, it really comes down to, I think what happens is, your editorial page tends to lean one way or the other. If you're in a bigger metro or national paper, and I think then, I mean, this happened a lot all the time when I was at the LA Times. I would get letters and emails from readers who were really referring to something that was on the editorial page, but used it to say that the newspaper itself, the reporting on Trump, let's say, was biased to the left. And you know, you try to answer some of those and kind of point out the differences that the editorial page is separate and is really a voice of the institution. It does not it has no bearing on how we report daily on a story. But that only goes so far, and I think that's where, at least on a national level, that's where a lot of the distrust comes from. The Wall Street Journal is their editorial page is right leaning. I would find it hard to. They've done some very tough reporting on Trump in their news pages. I just don't see the bias that we're hearing about.
We talked, Jim, about the Trump administration being good for business. What about news fatigue? Leighton Cook on our Facebook page wrote that people want to escape the news, and if it makes them feel bad, they shy away from it or go into a shell. Are you concerned about consumers choosing to escape by not opening the paper or not opening the website, just turning off, disengaging?
I don't think they can do it. No. I don't think they can do it. It's just there's so much out there that.
Yeah, I think consumption is higher than I think news consumption is higher than it's ever been.
It's overwhelming.
I wish they would read the paper.
You can choose not to watch MSNBC on a Tuesday night, and choose not to watch Fox on a Tuesday night. You don't have to do it, but you're doing it, and you don't have to pick up the paper and read our editorial page, and get mad at George Wolf because he criticized the president, but you do it. I think in this day and age, it's almost impossible to escape it. It's just all over the place. I mean, you can't go to a doctor's office and not have CNN on.
Charlie Schlenker with GLT.
And culturally, really, Apple has done far too good a job making phones addictive to prevent us from continuing to consume news. And our culture has not yet adjusted to signing out and exercising discipline in how we absorb information.
Well, even to that point, when you think that you're staying away from the news and you're falling into the Facebook hole, you're still getting news. I mean, everywhere you look, like Mark was saying.
So no one here has seen a decline in readership or listenership or web hits, nothing like that?
Our web page has more than doubled in usage in the last year, and part of that is richer content, but part of it is just the moment in time that we're at.
Yeah, our web traffic is way up from 2 or 3 years ago, and even up this past year with all the competition out there.
And WJBC.
Oh well, I can't give the numbers only because I've been there for a month, but I would say that we're getting a lot of hits, and I mean even our Facebook page is getting a lot of hits.
And Jim.
Yeah, and you know it's everything from not just politics. When we saw just as public service, right? I mean during the fires that broke out in Northern California last October, November, and then right around L.A., just north of L.A. in January, February, tremendous engagement. And I just had readers send me notes saying how much they were happy with, where is the fire today? Or how are they going to be affected? They're really counting on the paper to deliver that type of information. And one short aside, I had a woman in her 70s who was displaced by the fire. We couldn't, was living in a motel for a while. We couldn't get the paper to her for 2 days. Finally got a paper to her. She kept pleading, calling my assistant, can you please somehow get the paper to me? And we ended up getting the paper to her in a hotel around the fire zone. Sometimes we'd get there 3 in the afternoon. She could not be more gracious and writing letters every day thanking us for getting that news to her. So, you know, that I think people in all the noise of this fake news, people I think forget the public service that papers provide and news organizations, TV and radio as well, provide on a daily basis. It's essential, and the resource issue is real, and newsrooms have to face that on a daily basis on what to cover, picking and choosing what to cover and what not to cover. Those are important decisions that, frankly, we didn't have to make 20 years ago.
Now, let's talk about resources for a moment. In my opening, I referenced the role the media plays in our democracy, the watchdog function. On a national level, Jim, are the resources there to cover this administration?
You know, I think certainly outside of the New York Times and the Washington Post, which I think are anomalies, we obviously have seen a decline in the press corps in Washington. I do think when you look at what's there have been some great additions to fill that gap. You know, when you look at Politico and you look at what Bloomberg has done in terms of really staffing up in Washington, and you have a number, you have Vox, you have a number of these startups that are putting real journalists on that story. You know, I would say on a national level, where and this was mentioned in the panel before, where it gets really scary and dangerous is in middle America, where you have state governments that are not covered at all. You know, you have state legislators and governors, their actions are just not being covered in some cases, and that's where it's really concerning, I think. And there is a real problem. How to afford that type of reporting is nobody has the answer to yet.
And related to that, is all the coverage of the special counsel, the Russian probe, the Manafort trial, the departure of the EPA director, all of those sorts of things, eliminating space for some other important stories? Are there stories going uncovered because of the amount of attention the Trump administration is getting?
You know, I think there is. I do think in cases like in California, you have a lot of attention paid to environmental issues and you know, immigration issues just because it's such a major story there. I do fear that the some of those stories do get drowned out by just sort of the daily craziness that's coming out of Washington. You know, there again, it comes down to resources. How many hours in a day can you give to news? You know, it's a real balancing act today that you probably didn't face 10, 15 years ago.
Mark Pickering?
Well, yeah, I think in our market, the where we've had to shrink is on the outlying counties. You know, we used to have bureaus in Lincoln and in Pontiac. We had reporters who would go into the outlying counties almost every day, looking for stories and covering, you know, stories in those areas. That is really hard to do right now because we, you know, our main circulation is McLean County and the surrounding counties, surrounding communities. So, you know, it's a hard decision sometimes to say, you know, can we send a reporter up to Pontiac to cover a story? And, you know, you calculate the drive time and how long they're going to be there. So it's a half a shift is going up there for that one story. Is that worth it when that person, if he or she was back here, might be covering some other stories that also need to be covered? It's a tough call sometimes. If I had a wish, I'd have a couple more reporters and I would just throw them out to the region. But that's, as Jim said, that the resources are harder to come by. We, you know, back to something earlier, we have an opening in our newsroom right now. We'll get a lot of applicants for that job. We won't have any problem filling it. And the applicants are going to be solid young journalists. So I'm not worried about that. But how we use that young journalist is the trick. And we'll figure it out.
Catherine Murphy with WJBC. We have Mark Pickering talked about his wish list. What kind of resources would you like to have? And where would you throw those reporters?
More reporters. I mean, in the afternoon, evening, I have one person. Or maybe if I could just get the normal school district and Bloomington School District to do their meetings on a different night.
That would help.
That would really
that would
help.
Us too.
I have one person to cover both meetings on Wednesday night. And then we had another event that happened prior to the District 87 meeting. So I had to split. I had to bring in a part-timer to cover this, cover that, just more people, more bodies, because as medium-sized this market is, there's a lot of news to cover, but we just can't be everywhere that we need to be all at once.
And Laura Trendopoulos, representing the Illinois News Broadcasters Association, you talked about attending a working news meeting in Peoria TV newsroom. What are you hearing from around the state in terms of resources and the needs? I mean, how many one-man bands are there out there in local stations around?
A ton, yeah. A ton. And people at radio stations have to take pictures and do video. I will say, in our market here, where you're watching the Peoria stations, we saw the demise of WHOI, the ABC affiliate. It got subsumed by WEK back in probably 2007, and most of the people got fired at that point. But I've been pleased to see them build back up. They are now a fully staffed station. They have a full anchor team. They have their own meteorologists. They have a full morning team. They have a full weekend team. Those are all actual real people with real jobs, and that's awesome. Only the reporters are being shared between the stations right now.
Jim Kirk?
Yeah, I was just going to add that, and Mark and I had a little bit of a discussion about this before the event, but you're seeing a lot more partnering being done, especially former competitors or, you know, frenemies, as we like to call them. When I was at the Sun-Times, we obviously went through several staff reductions. I had to make the decision about what type of paper we were going to have. Going forward, we felt our bread and butter was really city coverage, you know, education, politics in Chicago. We pretty much had abandoned suburban coverage, which that's a big step. You know, we have a terrific readership still in the suburbs, so we went to the Daily Herald out in Arlington Heights and formed a partnership. They would give us content. We'd give them city content. No money exchange hands. You know, we were fiercely still competitive on certain beats, but, you know, this is sort of the reality we're in. And there are some great investigative groups. ProPublica just opened shop in Chicago, very strong investigative chops. They hired a number of great data investigative reporters, and they're looking to work with newspapers around the state. And have done some great data reporting with local reporters at papers around the state, and it become a really essential reporting tool to support newsrooms that have obviously faced some tough times.
We asked the audience at this forum to fill out a questionnaire asking about what they think are the most important issues for local media to cover. Topping the list was economic climate and economic development, government accountability, violence, poverty, and environmental issues. Any of those come as a surprise to anyone on this panel?
I didn't think you wanted to hear about violence. We hear that a lot. Too much violence on the news. The WGN news is, you know, 25 minutes of solid rape, murder. So I'm surprised by that.
I question that. Violence, or is it public safety?
Sure.
I would put, I'm not sure you'd cover violence. I think public safety is always been number
one. Or violence reduction.
Violence reduction with all the recent things here. But public safety is certainly not a surprise. I'm a little surprised by the environmental aspect, but the rest of it is right on board.
Could consider the public radio audience. Environmental issues would certainly. Government accountability, is that a surprise? I mean, everyone here covers government, you know, both Bloomington City Councils, at least local governments, the school boards when we can.
Right.
Is that a surprise to anyone, that government accountability is something that we ought to be covering?
It's one of the core functions of media, of reporting, is to do that. And we watch the guardians of our tax dollars.
Okay, that's Charlie Schlinker with WGLT. Panelists, thanks for your time to help celebrate the fifth anniversary of Sound Ideas with a GLT community conversation, journalism in the era of fake news. Jim Kirk is Vice President for Strategic Initiatives with Tronc Inc., which owns the Chicago Tribune and other major newspapers. Catherine Murphy is WJBC News Director. Laura Trendopoulos is the Director of ISU's TV10, educating journalism students, and she's President of the INBA. And Mark Pickering is an editor with the Pantograph, and I mentioned Charlie Schlinker is News Director of WGLT. This community conversation is made possible with a grant from the Alice and Fannie Fell Trust. Find this and past editions of Sound Ideas at WGLT.org. And our website is also where you can subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. I'm Mike McCurdy, and this is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.